very interesting, which is, why are we here? And I have to say that this question is really, really pertinent for me this morning. I know basically nothing about adiabatic quantum computation. I've worked a little bit on these phase transitions for random constraint satisfaction problems, and I'll try to give everybody some flavor of the subject. My understanding is that it relates to the hopes that people have for adiabatic computation, and perhaps by the end of the talk, you might have a better idea of why I'm here, but you can tell me then. So I think easily the most important result in computer science is Crookes' theorem, which says that pretty much every reasonable verification task is equivalent to checking whether a formula is satisfiable. So what I mean by this is you're given a formula in CNF, which is basically an AND of ORs, and the question is there an assignment of values to the variables of the formula so that each one of the ends, each one of the ORs, which we're talking about clauses, evaluates to one, which means that it has at least one satisfied variable. And I'm not going to explain exactly what it means to say that satisfiability is meant to complete. The essence of the task is that if someone, let's say, gives you a collection of points and makes a claim that there is a way to go through all the points exactly once, so that the total distance that you travel is no more than, let's say, 1,000 miles, then you can write down a formula which encodes exactly the same claim. So that claim will be true if and only if you can find an assignment to the variable that satisfies it. And the reason that this works is basically that the nature of computation in Turing machines is local. So what this means is, as Andrei showed yesterday on the board, you have a head, and at any given moment, the head applies some very local rules. It looks at what's underneath the head, it looks at the state, and then it makes a very local change. So in Crookes' original proof, this is exactly what this clause is captured. Okay, the local constraints that certify the fact that your machine is going to be really doing the computation as prescribed. Now, it turns out that when you want to show that other problems are also anti-complete, it's easy to work with formulas in which each clause has exactly k variables. And this motivates k-sat, which is interesting if k is at least 3. If every clause has left exactly 2, then deciding whether the formula is satisfiable or not is really easy. You can do it all one at a time. You basically just make a guess, and then what happens is every clause either goes away because it feels satisfied, or it shrinks down to a single choice because the variable was contained in the opposite way of what you said it. So you take care of that implication, you keep doing it, and either you're left with a contradiction or you're left with a support formula. In both cases, you know what to do.
A lot of people that are not familiar with these satisfiability problems, and Andrew explained briefly yesterday, maybe you should go through very carefully how you interpret,
My impression was that everybody was completely bored by looking at the faces. So I was about to speed up.
I think you should explain how to interpret that formula.
So that's a logical end. That's a logical or. So in order for this string to be satisfied, you need that either x12 is set to 0 or x5 is set to 1, or both.
Because the bar means negation.
That's right.
Well, the x's are 0 or 1, that's what you're saying.
Yes. I'm sorry, yes. Yeah, that's right. Yes, so these are Boolean variables. They can be either 0 or 1. If you set this one, if you set x12 to 0, it means that there's negation, evaluates to 1, which means that this 4 evaluates to 1. So you're covered this spot. Okay?
You might want to explain conjunction form as well, whether it's a conjunction and disjunction rather than.
Yeah, so.
You have disjunction.
You mean the flip side, like explain also that you can write this as BMF.
Well, you kind of skimmed over what CNF was. I don't know.
I think I said that it was an end of ORs.
Oh.
So So what you want to make sure is that each one of these ORs evaluates to one, every single one of them. So for example, for this one, you must set x12 to 1. There's no choice. Okay. For this one, on the other hand, out of the 8 possible ways of setting these variables, 7 are good and 1's bad. Okay? More generally, if a clause has left k out of the 2 to the k way of setting the variables, you've basically forbidden 1. Okay? That's what you've done. And if you want to think about this geometrically, you can look at 0, 1 to the n. You can just look at the hypercube. And then what each one of these constraints does is it kills off a subcube. Okay? And the question is, have you covered the whole thing? Or are there actually still points left? Have you thrown away everything? Or are there things left? Okay. And the hardness of the problems, in some sense, derives from the fact that the geometry of the set that's left is rather complex. At least that's what we think. So, yes?
So your k equals 2 is an algorithm in which there's a...
Yeah, that's the algorithm.
Well, I don't understand. There's, okay. there's a loop within the loop, or what is it doing?
Right, it's a loop.
First, you go over the, you list the variables, and there's a loop over those, and then there's a loop.
No,
there's
so what you do is, don't even bother looking at the formula, okay? Pick any variable that you like. Assign it any value that you like, okay? That's one step. So now, if you look at every clause, either it contains the variable or it doesn't contain the variable, right? If it doesn't contain the variable, you don't have to think about it. If it does contain the variable, then one of two things happens. Either the choice that you have made for this variable makes that clause happy, or it doesn't. So for example, if the variable that you chose was x5, and you set it to 1, then this clause is happy. If the variable that you chose was x5, and the choice that you made was set x5 to 0, then this clause is unhappy. Okay? So, if a clause is happy, pretend for a moment that you throw it away. Okay? You've already made that clause happen. So there might be some clauses which now have only one choice left. So imagine that your choice was x5 set to 0, then you know that you're forced to set x12 to 0. Right? So what I mean is, after you make that very first arbitrary choice, when you scan over the clauses, what you're going to be left with is a potentially empty collection of one clauses, clauses of length one, clauses that only have left one choice now. Okay? So you have no choice about that. So you just make all those settings because you're forced to, and then you repeat the same trick, and you keep going. Sorry.
Use the x5 and use x.
You use the force things, and now you do the scan again, and you see maybe they cause new forcings, and so on and so forth, right?
There is a kind of algorithm.
This is an algorithm, yeah.
There is a kind of altered loop where you first pick the x5, then you pick an x19, and then you pick the x5.
Yes, I'm sorry. So here I should have said repeat.
Okay.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what that was.
Sorry. About. Sorry. So what I want to make sure is that if at some point you end up with no forced choices, you can safely deduce that the original choice that you made was okay, because you now have a subformula of the original thing. Right? So if this is satisfiable, the whole thing is satisfiable, and vice versa. And the intuitive reason that things become nasty when k squared or equal to 3 is that you don't have this immediate forcing. You pick a variable, you set it. Now, the variables that are happy, fine, but the variables that are unhappy, you still have to make a choice. Okay? You don't get immediate forcing, and this is what causes sort of the combinatorial blow-up. Yes?
I don't quite understand what you mean by your literal.
Oh, sorry. Yes. So a literal is either a variable or its negation. It's a generic term. So each one of these objects is a literal.
Okay.
And it consists of either a variable or the negation of the variable.
Okay.
Yeah? So what I mean, sometimes I will also refer to this as the length of the clause. So this clause has two literals, x12 naught and x5. This clause has four literals. Yeah?
A clause is whatever is in this practice.
Exactly.
And
it's
you
the
want
or.
All these clauses to be
simultaneously
satisfied.
You know what? Okay, one second. So this was going to be the second part, but maybe it's better to just do it now. So the general setting is a mean field spin class. Okay. So what I mean by this is,
when you're too pure, you need to write, you talk about physics.
Well, most who can't do teach and so on. But so basically, the idea is the generic set is you have a number of variables n. They have discrete domains, that's the context. Small generally, like I don't know, 5, 10, 2, okay? And then you have a bunch of functions, okay? And each function takes as input a very small subset of the variables. Okay, these are your interactions. And what it means is basically, it looks at the possible values that can be assigned jointly to the functions, to the variables, and to each one of these joint assignments, it assigns a number. So in the case of satisfiability, it says, okay, I'm going to be looking at k variables. They can take 2 to the k possible values jointly. Mm-hmm. To all of those values, I'm going to assign 1, except for a particular one to which I'm going to assign 0. Okay, the one that makes the OR evaluate to 0. Mm-hmm. And what we're interested in is the product of those functions. That's basically
the value of this function or.
But in principle, it could even be real value. At some point, actually, it will be useful to have real value function.
Okay.
Okay? In general. In most cases, they tend to be integer value. Like, for these two spins are aligned, these two spins are not aligned. Something like that. So that's the general setting. So, and actually, I'm pretty happy that people stop and ask questions. I think we should keep doing this. I have no particular sort of agenda that I want to cover. So I mean, the more you get out of it, the better. So, are there any other questions about the basic set? So Cook, you know, published his theorem in the early 70s, and pretty quickly people started putting all sorts of other problems that are anti-complete. And the way you typically do this is you say, well, if you have an instance of this problem, it reduces to an instance of satisfiability and vice versa. And if you look at these reductions, they're these extremely fragile objects. Okay? If you want to encode, let's say, a version of traveling salesman of satisfiability, you have to construct this really, really particular point set. Okay? So that the reduction goes through. So people saw that as a potential weakness of this system. And basically said, yes, maybe, okay, there is a big weakness, but it's not a terribly robust notion. Maybe in reality, the vast majority of formulas are really easy. And we're making a big fuss about some really tiny, weird examples. So they proposed models for generating, you know, examples of satisfiability formulas at random. And it turns out that most models generated formulas that are either really easy to solve. So either you can easily find the truth assignment, or you can easily prove that there is no satisfying assignment. Okay? Except for one model known as random k-sat, which so far seems to be withstanding some serious testing. It's not clear that the formulas generated under this model are hard, but it's certainly the harder of the models that we know. And the way I like to think about this problem is you basically, you make a big bag. And so you have some fixed canonical set of n variables in the background. And you take a bag and you put in it all possible models of left k for these n variables. So to form an OR, what you do is, you first pick your k variables, let's say that we're forced that they're distinct. So there's that many ways to pick the variables, and each variable either gets negated or it doesn't get negated. So these are all the possible flows of left k on n variables. You put them in a bag, and then you start drawing from that bag and stringing them together in an n. Okay, that's the model. And the notation, so we're going to have a formula. It's going to be a k-CNN formula in the set that every clause is going to have left exactly k. It's going to be on n variables, and it's going to have exactly n clauses. Okay, that's the model. So in the picture that I showed earlier as a bipartite graph, we have the n variables in one side. We're going to have exactly n boxes in the other. Each box is going to have k edges going out. Okay, and the function sitting here, it evaluates to 1 for all inputs except for 1 out of the 2 to the k possible ones. And the big thing that we care about is whether it is possible to assign values to the variables 0 or 1 so that every single one of these functions evaluates to 1. And the randomness of the whole thing simply amounts to the fact that the edges that go from the left side to the right side are chosen uniformly at random. So each variable picks, sorry, each clause picks k variables uniformly at random. subject to that silly constraint about them being distinct, and even that we are essentially ignored. That's just a technicality.
We put the same probability to each.
Each clause, yes, right? So, very gentle. So another way of thinking about it as drawing from the back is you set up the n variable. Here, you set up the n clauses here. And for each clause, you just pick k variables at random. Okay? And then for each one of these, you either say negate or not negate, also uniformly at random. Yeah? And these are your interactions.
And escape means that there's only one drawing from each circle to the bottom.
Yeah, like you don't want to have a clause that looks like, you know, or x2 not. Okay? Just because in some sense, this is not really a clause of left take. Right? But this is really just a technicality. I mean, it is easy to show. Since the interesting regime is going to be the regime in which the number of constraints is linear in the number of variables. So such collisions are going to be like a Poisson variable with bounded means, and you just throw those away. It doesn't matter. Okay?
And the way you choose your variables. There is, they have no locality problem.
That's okay, great. Great. Actually, darn, I'm doing this in wrong order. So, do I have that slide? I don't know. No, I'm sorry. Exactly. So, the essential part of mean fieldness here is there is no underlying geometry which says that the probability that two things interact is related to some underlying method. No. Okay. It's completely mean field. Okay. But I did say that.
Right.
I did say that. Yeah? So there is no underlying geometry at all. I also claim that, in some sense, that's going to be partly what makes the problem hard, the lack of underlying geometry. Yeah. So maybe the next sentence will give a little bit of intuition about what I mean about this. Yeah? So that's the model, okay? So one of the most concrete results that we have suggesting that this model is hard is this very nice theorem by Fatal and Semeredi from the late 80s. And I'm going to take a little bit of time just to make sure to parse this. Okay, the main unknown word for non-computer science is resolution, okay? So if I give you a formula and the formula is satisfiable, if I somehow happen to know a satisfying assignment, it's really easy to convince you of that fact. I just show it to you, right? I just show you how you have to set the variables, and then what you have to do is n checks, and whatnot. You're convinced that it's satisfiable, okay? And not exactly equivalent, but essentially equivalent formulation of the P versus NP question, the big question in computer science, is that if I want to convince you that the formula is not satisfiable, that's much harder to do. Okay, so in particular, I can't really convince you by providing you a certificate which is short. More or less, what we have to do is enumerate every possible solution and verify that it, potential solution and verify that it doesn't do the job. Okay? We certainly don't know this for a fact. Okay? And enumerating all possible solutions is pretty much the stupidest proof system we could have. Okay? So we have a hierarchy of proof systems, which are, you know, some relatively stronger than others. The resolution is a relatively weak proof system, but at the end of the day, it's pretty much what every computer program that does verification uses. Maybe a few extra tricks, but at the core of it is resolution. We don't really have anything which is genuinely, substantially, all the time stronger than resolution. Okay? So it doesn't really matter what the resolution is. It's a proof system, it's a little bit more sophisticated than exhaustive enumeration, but not terribly much. Okay. So what Fatal and Semeredi showed is that fix some k greater or equal to 3 so that the problem is anti-complete, otherwise it's not interesting. And then pick some real number, any one that you like, which is more than 2 to the k. So let's say k is 3, 2 to the k is 8, so pick this number to be 9. Okay, it could also be 9.1237, it doesn't matter, but 9 is 2. Then there exists some real number which is strictly bounded away from 0. It depends just on 3 and 9. Such that the formula that you're going to generate, if it contains n variables and 9 times n floaters, with probability that tends to 1 as n tends to infinity, is unsatisfiable. And every single resolution proof of this fact has exponential size. Okay? So if you could convince yourself, something which is probably not true, that the resolution is as good as it gets as proof system goes, this proves that, you know, in some sense, P is different from NP, and moreover, the gap is really, really huge. Okay? Of course, resolution is not the strongest thing, but we're not sure that something really much stronger exists. Okay? But this already shows you that, in some sense, random formulas are hard. Not necessarily in the sense of finding solutions, but at least they're hard in the sense that when they are satisfiable, they're not unsatisfiable for some local reason. Okay? What I mean by this is, if this is the whole formula, okay, with n variables and 9 times n closures, it's impossible to isolate a relatively small subformula, which by itself implies that the whole thing is unsatisfiable. So it's kind of like holistic.
Kind of. What if the number of clauses was proportional to n squared?
So at n squared, it's much easier. I think by now we're down to n to the 3 cups plus epsilon.
Oh, okay. So
I think that that's the case. And I'm not sure that in that case you go with the resolution. You go with something else.
No, I'm sorry. What do you mean? N to 3? What are you talking about? Which variable? If I meant the number of clauses is n squared. Oh, you said if it's n to the 3 halves, then they're unsatisfiable, but you can show it.
Yes, but not with resolution. But the point is, it's not terribly satisfactory.
Okay, so really the interesting case is when the number of clauses is proportional
That's right.
to the number of
That's right.
bits.
That's right. Okay?
Yeah.
Intuitively, the reason is that when the number of clauses is linear, when the number of clauses is linear in the number of variables, these formulas are locally tree-like. Okay, so they very much look like, I don't know if you're familiar with LDPC codes. It looks very much like that setting. So, you know, you pick your variable. Sorry, I'm starting on the. Yeah, okay, no, I'm starting here. So, it's going to participate in some closures. Okay? These are going to contain some variables. Okay? Sorry, so each one of these is exactly 3. This doesn't have to be 3, it could have been 4. And so on and so forth. And this from here has to grow to size at least square root of n before it stops being a tree. So that by the Berkeley paradox, you start seeing a few things that you've already seen. Okay? So if you take a typical variable in this bipartite graph that I showed, and you just explore its neighborhood, you keep seeing fresh stuff all the time. Okay? It takes a while before you start having basically back edges. Does this make sense? I mean, it's not entirely obvious what this is true, but I just want to make sure that it makes sense.
So the distance you go this way is log.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. And this local tree lineness is very much invariant under, you know, so you're going to have the number of clauses n is going to be c times n for some constant. Actually, I'm going to usually call this constant r as in the ratio of clauses to variables. Right. So this local tree likeness is true for pretty much any constant value of R. It can be really small, it can be really big, it doesn't matter. Okay. Yeah. So I hope that at, you know, some very vague intuitive level, this local tree likeness connects a little bit with the idea that there are no local subformulas which attest to the unsatisfiability. Okay. Any questions? So another a picture that sort of, you know, generated a lot of the interest in this area is this experimental picture from the early 90s by Mitchell, Solomon, and Levesque. And they run some experiments of generating formulas at random and then trying to solve it. Okay. So the x-axis is the same on both plots, and it is the ratio of closest to variables. So these are experiments for k equals 3. Okay, so it's random free set. And this is the ratio of closest to variables. I don't know if you can read this, is like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And the bottom plot is the probability that the random formula is satisfiable. And the different colors corresponds to increasing the number of variables, increasing the size of the system. Okay? The top plot is the median running time of a specific satisfiability algorithm. Okay, so I say median, which is a bit better than saying mean in this context. And it is a specific algorithm, but this picture is pretty robust, the top picture. If you try a different algorithm, it'll look very similar to this. Most algorithms we know look like that. So it kind of looks like that the probability that a random formula is satisfiable drops precipitously around some critical point. And that critical point depends on k, just if it's 3-sat, 4-sat, or so on. And this has motivated the satisfiability threshold conjecture, which just formalizes this step function intuition, which is that for every k greater or equal to 3, there exists some constant r sub k, the critical ratio of closures to variable for that k, such that if the number of closures is slightly below that, like if the density of your formula is slightly below the critical one, then it's almost surely satisfiable. If it's slightly above, it's almost surely unsatisfiable. Okay? So that's a concrete mathematical statement. The picture itself also kind of suggests some sort of slightly mystical connection between phase transitions and complexity. And if we have enough time, I might try to convince you something that the physicists convinced me of, which is that actually this analogy is rather weak, and in fact complexity starts happening significantly before the point where unsatisfiability comes into picture. Okay.
Is this Levesque, the guy from the liquid theory, or
no.
Who did this? No,
he's a
computer guy?
No, he's a computer. That's right. He's a computer guy. No.
So this is a conjecture because it's not proven.
That's right. That's right. So we still don't know whether such a constant, such a critical thing exists.
But something is proven, right?
Right. That's what I'll spend most of the time talking about.
Well, something weaker.
That's right. So, but this was a situation, you know, from the early 90s, and a lot of the work through the 90s, and, you know, I should think about now, centers around this conjecture. Forget about the complexity aspect. Can we prove that the 0-1 picture is true? Can we get good bounds for this point? So by the way, for k equals 2, it's easy to prove that there is a step function. It happens when the ratio of closed variables is 1. And the proof essentially boils down to the question of, in that simple algorithm that I described not too long ago, I said pick a variable, set it any way you like, follow the implications, repeat. Okay. So by this local tree-likeness process, it's not hard to show that this is basically a branching process. Okay. And the question is the expected progeny of this branching process more than 1 or less than 1? That's exactly what that 1 corresponds to at the end of the day. If it's less than 1, then the forced implications die off very quickly. So you win, otherwise you die. So for k greater or equal to 3, it's easy to prove these two bounds. Okay. The critical point is somewhere between 2 to the k and 2 to the k over k. Something which is not nearly as easy to prove.
Like if it exists.
That's right.
How can you prove something along for something you don't know
even
exists?
I mean, I was hoping to avoid limp soups. Okay, there you go. So if it exists, it's somewhere there.
Okay.
There's a lot of cynical comments actually that I want to make about this. So here's a much harder statement. Okay? This is essentially a non-uniform version of the conjecture. So what I mean by this is if you drop these, that's exactly the conjecture, okay? So Frege could prove that the conjecture is true if you allow me the possibility that the critical point actually depends with n. Okay? So in principle, it could oscillate, for example. Okay? Nobody believes that it does, but his method of proof cannot exclude this possibility. So his method of proof establishes that as n gets bigger and bigger, the interval within which you go from almost really satisfiable to almost really unsatisfiable gets narrower and narrower. Yes?
I mean, this thing here grows with n, and your bound is independent of n.
No, so this is a constant.
Yes.
This is a constant that could depend on n. So it could be, for example, so that
it can only vary
within an interval. Absolutely.
Within an interval.
Yes. And in fact, nobody even believes that it varies. Okay. So basically, if for example, for every fixed n, you can define a quantity which is at what density does the probability subscriber equal 1/2. Okay, let's just be precise and concrete. Okay, this is a sequence of n. Everybody believes that the sequence converges. Okay? At the critical point. Because it's too different. Okay? But in any case, so his theorem establishes that a sharp threshold does exist, but it could be that its location shifts with n. Okay? And then if it shifts, it shifts with somewhere within this window. So a concrete realization of this would be that, you know, for the case k equals 3, if n is even, the critical probability happens when the density is 4.1, when n is odd, it's 4.15, for example. Okay? Yeah?
It can have several.
On the previous slide, didn't you have rk of n equal to 1/1? You had an rk.
It wasn't dependent
on n. But it didn't depend upon n, but it was conjectured to be.
Right. So it's conjectured that it is an absolute constant, 4.2 something for k equals 3, right? So that if it's slightly less than that, it's almost really unsatisfiable. If it's slightly more, it's almost really unsatisfiable, okay? And what Friedman says is, I can't give you that much, okay, but I can show you that, you know, this limit does go to 1 and 0 around some sequence, as opposed to around some constant, okay?
So for k equals 3, you're not dividing by n, you're dividing by k. So for k equals 3, you have a, you can say, so if it exists, it's between 8 and 8/3.
One thing which follows from this theorem, and which actually turned out to be useful a number of times, is that if for some density, you can prove that the probability of satisfiability is constant, bounded away from zero, okay? So this is R, and this is probability of sat. If for some density, you can prove that the probability, I don't know, let's say 0.2, okay? At least 0.2. This implies that for every density slightly less than that, it is at exactly 1. Okay? Like the limit is 1. Okay? And the reason is if that were not the case, you would have an interval of non-vanishing length during which the probability would be neither 0 nor 1 contradicting this. Okay?
This is the trivial problem. N is integer.
Correct.
And on the right hand side you have N is also integer. So there is a strong restriction on integer.
Yes, but not terribly.
Sorry?
Yes, but not terribly.
But it means that R can only be up to an epsilon also, the rational.
No.
That's one of the big restrictions.
maybe an interest in the transcendental number.
I think maybe we're spending more time on this than we need to. All I'm going to say is, even the author does not believe in the slightest, okay, that the thing oscillates. This is just an artifact of the fact that the proof technique proceeds by basically going pointwise with respect to n, applying Fourier analysis for every finite n, and basically there is no uniformity in the proof. Okay, that's all this is. And therefore, the strongest statement you can extract from it is this. That's all. Okay. Everybody believes that it's a step function. Okay. And we will see that actually the bounds that we know are a lot better than this at this point. Okay. Still not narrow enough, but quite a bit better. So the one thing that I want to sort of just put in our bag of tools is that if for some particular density we can prove that things are satisfiable with constant probability, this implies that for any smaller density, they're satisfiable with probability 1 minus the rule of 1. That's something that follows with this. That's all. Okay.
Remember, we scheduled you for a second.
Sure.
Concept.
All right. Oh, people still want to talk to this. So this picture is a little bit outdated. Okay. And what it shows is the progress in range, you know, giving upper and lower bounds for this number for the case gate. Okay. So all these results are algorithmic. So there is some concrete algorithm which someone proves will find the solution with that probability if the density is no more than the corresponding number. And these are proofs of non-existence. So these are different arguments which prove that if the density is, you know, the vertical bar or higher, there are no solutions. And this picture is about circa 2000. By now, the best numbers, I think, are about 4.501 and 3.51, something like that, okay, for which we have rigorous now. The reason these are in a box, I want to just a little bit of time to show you how computer scientists tend to work on this problem, is because the algorithmic analysis can be done sort of in a relatively uniform framework. Okay? So I want to spend a little bit of time saying how that's done. And the way it's done is actually not a particularly big sophistication over the naive algorithm I discussed for the case K equals 2. So the algorithm is, if you ever have toilets of length 1 lying around, like forced choices, you always take care of those. If you don't have forced choices, you're faced with a mix of 3 closets and 2 closets. Look at the mix and somehow pick some variable that you would like to set a particular value. Perform that step, see if it generates any forced choices, take care of those, and then just go back. Okay? So the basic scheme is you're facing a mix which is just 3 closets in the beginning. You pick some variable, you set it. You know, after you do this for a bit, you might have 1 closet. You always take care of 1 closet if they exist. And then you return to a state in which you have 2 closets and 3 closets. Okay. And pathetic as it might sound, we never backtrack. Okay. We don't know how to analyze backtracking algorithms. Okay. That's it. So every decision is final. It's forever. Okay. So silly non-backtracking algorithms like that already can give you numbers like, you know, 3 for the case k equals for random free sour. 3.003, and by now it's even a bit better algorithms. In fact, this algorithm, okay, it says in the step that you're supposed to do something intelligent, in fact, doesn't even look at the formula. Okay, this algorithm basically says, don't bother looking at the formula. Okay, take your variable, set it at random. Have someone else implement the choices that you made, and have them warn you if you ever have a close on left 1. In that case, you just do what you have to do until you return into a state where there are no closes on left 1, in which, again, you do something completely arbitrary. OK? So this is about as lame an algorithm as you could think of. Okay. And this, for case k plus 3, gives you a third. And for general k, it gives you 2 to the k over k. Okay. That's the bound I showed earlier. And that's the best algorithm we have. We have not managed to escape lameness in any way. Okay. So For finite values of k, like k equals 3, you can do, you know, silly little biases that will get you something. Okay? So for example, by analogy to the fact that one closures are really bad because they're forced, you can think of when you're faced with a mixture of three closures and two closures, well, then maybe you should actually take care of some two clause rather than just doing something completely arbitrary. So you pick a two clause, you pick a variable in it, and you do what it wants. Okay? That gives you 3.003. Okay. And the common framework in which all this analysis fit is that you can model the execution of the algorithm as some kind of a card game. So imagine that someone generates the formula, takes a piece of paper, and writes down the literal. So it takes one piece of paper for each literal. And then takes those pieces of paper and puts them face down. So you don't really get to see what these literals are. Okay? So this is one clause of map 3. So when you first enter the room, this is a full matrix. It's 3 by m. Okay? But all you see is these white pieces of paper. Okay? And then what you can do is you can name some variable. You can say x27. Or you can point to some specific card. Okay? And when you do so, either one of these things, the corresponding occurrences of this variable get revealed. So if you say x27, every card that carries x27 gets flipped over. Okay, or x27 not. If you point a card and it has variable x12 on it, everything that contains x12 or x12 not gets revealed. At that point, you have to make your decision. Okay? Closures that got satisfied by your decision get completely wiped out, so you throw away all the cards. Cards that are unsatisfied by your decision get thrown away, so you're left with a partial picture. Okay? And it's easy to see that all the algorithms I described in the previous slide can be implemented in this context. Okay? For example, the super naive algorithm that never really looks at the formula basically, you know, just announces a random variable and a random value, some closes shrink down to that 2, it keeps going. At some point, some problem has only one part. At that point, it points at that part, and it just takes care of this. Okay? Another way of thinking about it is with respect to that bipartite graph. Okay? It's like that bipartite graph exists, but you don't really see the edges at the beginning. And then you can point at objects at either side and reveal what those edges are and make your action. Okay? And the reason that we're going through this dance is because it allows us to maintain that this residual formula, the formula of closures that are left, is uniformly random, okay, conditional on the number of closures of each left that it contains, okay, because you know really nothing other than I have that many closures of left 3, that many closures of left 2, that many closures of left 1. Okay. And because of that reason, you can carry out some kind of analysis. I mean, ideally, you would like an algorithm which picks a variable, looks, you know, at a big ball around it, thinks about it for a bit, makes something intelligent, okay, and then does it again. The problem is that to establish that it does something intelligent, you have to more or less look at the random variable, which is the goodness of your choice as a function of what you explored. You want that to be a random variable, which it is at the very beginning, when you look for the very first variable. But when you try for the second variable, if its ball intersects with that ball, you don't have independence anymore. Okay, and you just, at that point, you just give up. Okay, we just don't know how to say this. And this is not just in the context of this problem. I mean, in probability, we basically don't know how to deal with this. Another way of thinking about it is you can think of this picture I showed in the previous one also organized in this way. Initially, you have three buckets, and bucket I contains all closures of length I. So initially, all your closures are in this bucket. Okay? When a closure gets satisfied, it goes out of the system. Otherwise, it shrinks and it goes to the next bucket down. Okay? So every time you set a variable, some closures go down, some closures move over, some closures stay closed. And all these algorithms have the property that they basically work if the rate at which you generate implications stays below 1 throughout the algorithm. So in a single step, it could be more than 1, okay? But if you think of this as some kind of a queuing system, you basically don't want to overwhelm the forced choices. If forced choices begin accumulating, at some point they will contradict each other. That's what happens. No? That's the basic idea.
So if you run these algorithms, it would take exponential time.
Below the threshold or above? Below their threshold or above their threshold?
I guess I'm asking above.
Below the threshold, they take linear time, right? Because they never backtrack.
No, but I mean, well, they never backtrack, and they're guaranteed, on a random instance, and they're guaranteed
right.
to find this.
Right. So, for example, the form of the theorem is something like, if you look at, let's call it the unit plug algorithm, right? The one which the only intelligent thing it ever does is if there's a clause of length 1, it takes care of it. Okay? And of course, if there's two clauses of length 1, one which says x3 and one which says x3 naught, it gives up because it's not allowed to backtrack and it can't satisfy both the clauses. Okay? So if we look at that algorithm, the theorem is that if the density of the formula, the ratio, if so.
The density r.
If r so for every p, if m is k k subsequent times n, then by this I mean with probability that tends to 1 as n tends to infinity, you see we'll find a satisfying to this thing. And I define here you see to be without backtracking, okay? Because the thing that gives up as soon as the very first configuration. Okay? An interesting question is what happens if you take this naive algorithm and you run it above its own breakpoint? Okay? There are results along those lines. And the best result that I know of is something that says, I'm faking it. With backtracking. So to be precise, so we will see later on in the talk that solutions exist for densities that are almost as high as the trivial upper bound. Okay? We will establish this by other means. Okay? It's trivial to show that there are no solutions for densities higher than this. I showed you this, but in fact even this is really, really easy to show. It's one line. And we will see that solutions exist for densities as high as that. Okay? So for anything k, which is more than 3 or 4 or something, this is a lot smaller than the largest point for which solutions probably exist. But algorithms like this one will start taking exponential time as soon as you go slightly above their breakpoint. By slightly above here, I mean, let's say 1.3 times the density that they can actually tolerate. Okay? And there is a conjecture. Okay? The conjecture is that actually you don't need this one. The conjecture is that for pretty much all those algorithms that can be modeled in this fashion, there is some critical point around which the following is true. If your density of your formula is less than that critical point, the algorithm will find the solution in linear time without any backtracking. If your solution is anything above that point, it will take exponential time. There is no intermediate regime. Okay. That's an algorithm-specific point, okay. But certainly much below due to the k. A particularly nice thing is that this conjecture, which is sort of an algorithmic slash complexity conjecture, is actually implied by a much simpler conjecture, which is just combinatorial, which is the following. So remember that if n2, so if we have a formula and the number of two clauses is 1 minus epsilon times n. Okay? This is a for satisfiable formula. This is the fact that k equals 2, the easy polynomial case, the satisfiability threshold is 1. Okay. Imagine that we allow ourselves to add to such a formula. You can make epsilon as small as you like. Delta times n clauses of length 3. Okay? The question is there some delta which is bounded away from 0 for which this mixture is satisfiable? Okay? So when I first saw this problem, my natural reaction was no way. This has to be something that goes to 0 as epsilon goes to 0. Maybe it's slower than epsilon, but it goes to 0. Physicists were saying, no, actually this delta can be as big as 0.71. Okay? So by now we know that indeed it can be as big as 2/3 times n. Okay? So if you have a mixture of 1 minus epsilon times n 2 clauses and 2/3 times n 3 clauses, this is a satisfiable mixture. So you can't add almost, so it's saturated in some sense with respect to 2 clauses, you can't add almost any of those. But as you can see, you could have added a lot of these. This is still not quite what the physicists say. Although, nicely, some of the physicists have revised and actually now claim that actually this is the right answer. Okay? So what's nice is this, okay? If indeed it's true that 2/3 is tight, okay, in other words, you can't have more than 2/3, and this is just in the combinatorial conjecture, I mean, it's just what it has nothing to do with computation, this implies the picture of from linear to exponential around a single point for a large class of algorithms. Okay? So if this is true.
Why do the physicists think that? Is that, can you say it?
Asking me to model why physicists think things like that. It's a fair idea, but are you saying where did they come up with 0.71, or why were they interested in the problem?
What, you know, what kinds of physicists are these? I mean, where did this, where did they get the information from?
All right, I see. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. Yes. They're good people.
I even co-authored the paper.
Okay, fair enough. I think their attempt at physics, their attempt was to, they thought, okay, so two sat is easy, three sat is hard. Can we actually interpolate, okay, between two sat and three sat? So what if we have a mixture of two clauses and three clauses? And what they thought was that if most of the clauses were two clauses, and then the computational complexity of the problem would look like the computational complexity of two sets. So it would be an easy problem. So if most of the clauses are three clauses, then it would look mostly like three sets. Then it would be a hard problem. And then there is also some related notions of first order and second order phase transitions with respect to the order parameter and so on. Okay? But this is how they go into the business of mixing two clauses with three clauses. And one of the things that came out of their phase diagram is that if you have 1 minus epsilon times n, 2 clauses, you can have as many as that many. 0.71 times n, 3 clauses. That's one of the things that came up. So this has been open now for a while. So it's been open for about 8 or 9 years, whether 2/3 is strict or not. It seems to be a pretty tough problem, like lots of people have tried. And I think the reason I find it particularly appealing is because it's just a statement upon probability, yet it provides some pretty nice contrast about the behavioral algorithms. It says there is no intermediate regime, if that's true. Are there any questions? I think I'm going to skip this. So I was going to talk just briefly about how do you prove something like this? And the short answer is, you need to keep track of the number of clauses of each length as a function of time. And you can write down, come on. You can write down on the left-hand side sequences, sorry, equations about random variables and the expected change of the delta as a function of time. And there's a nice theorem that basically says it's okay to interpret these as differential equations in the obvious way, solve them, and what you will get is essentially a rigor delta. So the only thing I want to get away from this is that basically saying, look, this is zero, okay? So if you look at the Drunkard's walk as a function of time, it's going to be some particular realization, okay? But you know that no matter where you are in the walk, the probability that you go up or down is the same, is 50-50. So it's like saying your walk has derivative zero everywhere. So what the theorem says, okay, fine, so solve the differential equation that corresponds to having the derivative zero everywhere, then walk away far enough, and this thing will look like a straight line. So the theorem says, derive differential equations from the difference equations, solve the differential equations. Those are going to give you some kind of path for the random variable you're interested in. And the theorem then promises that the actual realization is not going to stray very far away from that path. Okay, that's the main tool that you're going to employ. So, as I said, these slides were circa, you know, like the picture of the algorithm was circa 2000. Some proposals for doing a little bit better is to go beyond that parquet and come up with a representation of the residual formula that maybe you don't see the whole formula, but it allows you to see things like maybe the degree of each variable, how many closures it appear in. And if you allow such a somewhat more complicated notion of state, and you use that, you get the current best of like 3.5 or so. But as I said, for general k, the completely trivial algorithm gives 2 to the k over k. With some work, you can get 1.12 2 to the k over k. If you work even harder, you can get 1.7 2 to the k over k. Okay? And that's it. So when I said that we haven't escaped triviality for the general k case, what I meant is beyond the leading constant. So this completes exactly 1 hour. And maybe in the afternoon, I can talk about some progress that has happened since this. Yeah?
Yeah. I think we should step one for talk at 1:45 after lunch.
That's a really bad choice of sweat.
We should try to talk with you in the interest, sure. To let you know what.